Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us for HRA Financial's first quarter 2012 conference call. Joining me today are Stephen Freiberg, HRA's Chief Executive Officer, Matt Audette, Chief Financial Officer, and other members of HRA's management team. Before turning the call over to Steve, I'd like to remind everyone that during this conference call, the company will be sharing with you certain projections or other forward-looking statements regarding future events or its future performance. HRA Financial cautions you that certain factors, including risks and uncertainties, referred to in the 10-Ks and 10-Qs and other documents HRA files with the Securities and Exchange Commission, could cause the company's actual results to differ materially from those indicated by its projections or forward-looking statements. This call will present information as of April 19, 2012. Please note that HRA Financial disclaims any duty to update any forward-looking statements made in the presentation. During this call, HRA Financial may also discuss some non-GAAP financial measures in talking about its performance. The company provides these measures due to its belief that they provide important information about its operating results. These measures will be reconciled to the most directly comparable GAAP financial measures either during the course of this call or in the company's press release, which can be found on its website at investor.etrade.com. These non-GAAP financial measures should be considered in conjunction with the comparable GAAP measures. This call is being recorded, and a replay of this call will be available via phone and webcast beginning this evening at approximately 8 p.m. The call is being webcast live at investor.etrade.com. No other recordings or copies of this call are authorized or may be relied upon. With that, I will now turn the call over to Steve Freiberg.
Thank you, operator. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining today's call. I will begin by covering highlights from the quarter, and then Matt will take you through the results. I will follow with additional comments, after which we will open up the call for questions. The first quarter was a solid one on several fronts, as we generated some of the strongest customer metrics in the firm's history, made good progress in reducing risk on the legacy loan portfolio, and grew revenue sequentially despite a difficult interest rate environment. We reported earnings per share of 22 cents, which included a 9 cent per share income tax benefit on total net revenue of $489 million, representing a 3% sequential growth. Our brokerage business was quite robust this quarter. DARTs grew by 12% sequentially, while generating record net new brokerage assets of $4 billion in the quarter, an 11% annualized growth rate, and more than double the $1.7 billion in the prior quarter. Net new brokerage accounts of 46,000 were well above last quarter's 10,000. Our brokerage account attrition rate hit a record low, 8.7% annualized, marking the second consecutive quarter this metric has tracked below 10%. This is a significant improvement from the previous 3 years, which averaged 12%, and is a testament to our ongoing efforts to improve the customer experience. During the quarter, we were recognized by the American Customer Service Index with a first-place score among online brokers, the result of a 4% improvement in our score, the largest in our peer group. Brokerage-related cash also ended the quarter at the highest level on record at $31 billion, enabling us to offset the majority of net interest spread compression through volume. On the credit front, we made meaningful progress on our review of loan modification practices and procedures, which we discussed last quarter, and Matt will cover the details later in the call. I would point out that our legacy loan portfolio ended the quarter at $12.4 billion, down 6% sequentially and down 62% from its peak. Our overall delinquencies are down 56% from their peak and are at their lowest level in over 4 years. Meanwhile, special mention delinquencies are down 20% sequentially at their lowest level in 5 years. As for our customer offering, we launched several new products and enhancements during the quarter and unveiled two important website redesigns, rebuilding our storefront through a comprehensive retooling of our public website and completing the rollout of E-Trade 360, bringing a unique and streamlined experience to our customers. Both sites have been well received, and we continue to make refinements and optimize based on feedback and in-market testing. We will further enhance the prospect experience this year with the incorporation of new planning tools and improvements to the investor education section of our site, with a goal of deepening engagement and strengthening E-Trade's brand position as the place to receive the best investing experience. We also integrated a retail Forex offering into our product set for those more sophisticated active traders. In addition to these major launches, we rolled out a number of enhancements and upgrades to our existing platforms. We redesigned our Bond Resource Center to offer streamlined access to news, unbiased education, intuitive screeners to select individual bonds, and tools to help our customers quickly and easily build out the fixed income portion of their portfolio. We also made enhancements to E-Trade Mobile on both iPhone and Android, including mobile check deposit capability, complex options trading, and mutual fund trading. Yesterday, we announced voice recognition for the iPhone, allowing users to verbally prompt quotes and order tickets, as well as barcode scanning for iPhone and Android. We believe our mobile strategy is a highly differentiating element of our offering, and we have seen a steady increase in customer utilization, with 6% of our trades this quarter executed via mobile applications, up from 3% a year ago. We continue to bolster our retirement offering and believe we are on the right track to attain a meaningful presence in this category. The combination of our education and product offerings and our certified retirement planning counselors and financial consultants are helping us develop momentum in this area. Retirement assets now account for 16% of our total assets, and retirement accounts make up 28% of total brokerage accounts. During the quarter, we hosted our first ever all-day retirement education event with over 3,400 participants, comprised of both current and prospective customers. We continue to enhance our brand positioning, having used the Super Bowl to kick off a broad marketing campaign geared toward retirement and investing products and services. In summary, we feel good about our performance during the quarter, both in terms of our customer value proposition as well as our financial results, which Matt will now walk you through.
Thank you, Steve. For the first quarter, we reported net income of $63 million, or 22 cents per share, inclusive of a 9-cent per share tax benefit, which I will describe in more detail shortly. We generated $489 million in net revenue, up from $475 million in the fourth quarter of 2011, but down from $537 million in the first quarter of 2011. Our first quarter revenue included net interest income of $285 million, a sequential decline of just $4 million, despite 17 basis points of net interest spread contraction. While this decline in spread was in line with our expectations, growth in brokerage cash to its current levels is well above what we expected for the quarter. While this growth drove an increase in net interest income, it's a negative for net interest spread, as the marginal spread on a balance sheet that is increasing in size is lower, given our philosophy to maintain a modest level of interest rate risk. Last quarter, when we communicated expectations for net interest spread in 2012, to be slightly below 250 or 250 basis points, we had not predicted the significant growth in brokerage cash we experienced this quarter. Therefore, if our balance sheet remains at this elevated level, we expect that our net interest spread for the full year would be approximately 240 basis points. While we're incredibly pleased with the growth of the franchise and the customer cash that comes with it, our near-term priority is to improve our capital ratios through a reduction in our balance sheet size, with an eye on bolstering our leverage ratio. We are focused on reducing less efficient or non-strategic liabilities that are not core to our franchise. We do not have any specific actions to announce on this today, but we will provide an update when there's something specific to share. Commissions, fees and service charges, principal transactions, and other revenue in the first quarter were $173 million, up 11% from the fourth quarter, but down 14% from the same quarter of 2011. This sequential increase was driven by higher DARTs and a higher average commission, while the year-over-year change reflected declines in both of those metrics. Revenue this quarter also included $31 million of net gains on loans and securities, inclusive of a $3.5 million impairment. Total operating expenses rose sequentially by $2 million, mainly as a result of a seasonal increase in advertising and compensation, partially offset by the fact that the prior quarter included unique items of approximately $12.5 million. During the quarter, we recorded an income tax benefit of approximately $26 million related to certain losses on the 2009 debt exchange, previously considered non-deductible. In 2009, we exchanged $1.7 billion of interest-bearing debt for zero-coupon convertible debt, which generated a non-cash loss of $968 million, with a portion of that loss being non-deductible for tax purposes. Through additional research completed this quarter, we identified a portion of these losses that are deductible for tax purposes over the life of the debt. The result of this finding was a benefit to tax expense in the first quarter of approximately $26 million, with a corresponding increase to our DTA, which now stands at $1.6 billion. Without this adjustment, our effective tax rate this quarter was 45%. We continue to estimate our effective tax rate will trend in the mid-40s, primarily driven from the non-deductible portion of our interest expense on the 12.5% notes, which impacts tax expense by approximately $15 million annually. Our brokerage metrics this quarter reflected a better retail trading environment, as well as the strength of our franchise. DARTs for the first quarter were 157,000, a 12% increase from last quarter, but down 11% from a year ago. Net new brokerage accounts were 46,000 in the first quarter, up from 10,000 in the prior quarter, but down slightly from 51,000 in the first quarter of 2011. Net new brokerage assets totaled $4 billion during the quarter, representing 11% annualized growth. This was up from $1.7 billion last quarter and $3.9 billion in the first quarter of 2011. We ended the quarter with $31 billion in brokerage-related cash, an increase of $3.3 billion during the quarter. Meanwhile, customers were net buyers of $100 million of securities. Margin receivables ended the quarter at $5.3 billion, up $500 million from year-end, and averaging $4.9 billion during the quarter, flat with the prior quarter. Our legacy loan portfolio ended the quarter at $12.4 billion, a contraction of $780 million during the quarter, and is now down over 62% from its size at the peak. I will cover more on the quality of the book, but first I would like to address this quarter's provisions. During the quarter, we completed an evaluation of our portfolio of TDRs and certain modification policies and procedures to align with the guidance of our new primary banking regulator, the OCC. You may recall that we announced this evaluation last quarter and increased our reserves in anticipation of the results. Specific to existing modifications, the review resulted in a significant increase in charge-offs this quarter, which we believe addressed the key issues raised last quarter by our new regulator with respect to our TDRs. The majority of these charge-offs were previously reserved for through our standard allowance process and the increase to the qualitative component of the reserve recorded last quarter. With respect to our modification programs going forward, we have discontinued the programs that we suspended last quarter, particularly in home equity. Also, it's important to note that the level of loan modifications expected to occur through these programs in future periods was modest. Turning now to the allowance for loan losses for the quarter. It declined by $244 million to end the period at $579 million, including a general reserve of $326 million, which represents a coverage ratio of 63% of non-modified, non-performing loans. This coverage ratio is consistent with the trends reported in recent periods. The allowance also includes a reserve for TDRs of $205 million, which, combined with prior write-offs on TDRs totaling $445 million, constitutes a total expected loss of 37% of total TDRs, also consistent with trends reported in recent periods. The last component of the allowance is a $48 million qualitative reserve, which accounts for factors not considered in the quantitative loss model. Last quarter, we increased the qualitative component of the allowance by $67 million to $124 million, reflecting additional estimated losses due to reduced modification activity, as well as uncertainty around certain loans modified under previous programs. During the first quarter, we completed our review and charged off loan balances as a result, decreasing the specific valuation allowance and the qualitative reserve. Based upon this review and the associated balances that were charged off this quarter, we have returned the qualitative component of our allowance to 15% of our general reserve, so it currently stands at $48 million. The consistency of the reserve metrics I just described provides additional comfort that the level of our current reserve is adequate. Last quarter, we increased the qualitative component of the allowance by $67 million to $124 million, reflecting additional estimated losses due to reduced modification activity, as well as uncertainty around certain loans modified under previous programs. During the first quarter, we completed our review and charged off the loan balances as a result, decreasing the specific valuations, valuation allowance, and qualitative reserve. Based upon this review and the associated balance that was charged off this quarter, we have returned the qualitative component of the 15% of our reserve, so it currently stands at $48 million. Total net charge-offs in the quarter were $316 million, with approximately half related to this review and the remainder from the standard process of charging off loans. I gave a lot of numbers there and realized this may be difficult to follow, so let me try and sum it up simply. Last quarter, we announced a review to align certain policies and procedures with the guidance of our new regulators. We increased our reserves in anticipation of the outcome of that review. During the first quarter, we completed this review and charged off the increased reserves as a result. Now, I just have one final point to close out this topic, which is to stress that we expect our regulators to continue to review the treatment and performance of our TDR portfolio, which could have an impact on provision in future periods. And while we are confident that our current reserves are adequate, ultimately, we believe the actual performance of our loans, including those we have modified, will be the primary driver of reserve levels. With regards to the performance of our existing modifications, the average redelinquency rate 12 months after modification has remained stable at 28% for 1 to 4 family loans and 42% for home equity loans. Delinquency performance on all loans this quarter was quite positive, as the 30 to 89 day delinquent category improved 20% sequentially and 26% from a year ago. Total at-risk delinquencies of the 30 to 179 day delinquent category improved by 19% in the period and 33% from a year ago. One additional point on home equity. New supervisory guidance on the treatment of second lien home equity loans has garnered a lot of attention in the last week, and I'd like to address our status in implementing this guidance, specifically on the treatment of performing second liens behind non-performing first mortgages. Since the vast majority of our loans were purchased in the secondary market, situations where we hold both the first and second lien mortgage for the same borrower represent less than 1% of our portfolio. Given our lack of visibility into this population of loans, we rely on credit bureau data currently available to us to determine whether a borrower has a reported delinquency on any other debt obligation. Using this information, which is currently the best available to us, we estimate that less than 10% of our performing junior liens would be reclassified to non-accrual status pursuant to this guidance. It is important to emphasize, however, that in its current form, the credit bureau data that we use does not provide the specificity needed to determine whether the reported delinquency is tied directly to the corresponding first lien mortgage underlying our home equity loan. Accordingly, we are working to enhance this reporting. We expect to be in a position to have the necessary information to implement this guidance within the next quarter, and that the final amount of junior liens ultimately impacted by this guidance should be considerably less than our current estimate. Please note that interest payments received on non-performing loans are recognized on a cash basis in operating interest income until it is doubtful that the full payment will be collected, at which point payments are applied to principal and not recognized as income. We do anticipate this updated guidance will have any meaningful impact on our allowance for loan losses, as this credit bureau data is already a factor incorporated into our risk segmentation and provisioning process, so we do not anticipate this guidance will impact that. With respect to initial loan resets, as I mentioned last quarter, we do not expect these to be a material driver of credit costs this year. Thus far in 2012, we have seen approximately $560 million of 1 to 4 family mortgages reset for the first time, and we expect an additional $500 million to reset for the first time throughout the course of this year. Of the remaining balances which will reset this year, approximately 1%, or $6 million, is expected to experience a payment increase of 20% or more. On our home equity lines of credit, which represent three-quarters of the home equity portfolio, we have approximately $285 million that are already amortizing, with an additional $80 million expected to begin amortizing in the remainder of this year. As we have previously stated, the majority of these lines do not amortize until 2014 or later. On capital, at both the bank and the parent, our absolute levels of capital grew slightly from the previous quarter on both Tier 1 and risk-based measures. However, as I previously mentioned, growth in brokerage customer cash and the resulting increase to the size of our balance sheet drove a sequential decline in our leverage ratios. As for our progress in establishing a more comprehensive capital distribution plan with our regulators, our key next step is to submit a long-term capital forecast, including internally developed stress tests, by the end of the second quarter. And while we can't be certain on the timing or nature of their response, our objective is to get feedback on the plan, including the dividend process, by the end of the current calendar year. Corporate cash ended the quarter at $484 million, or just under three times our annual debt service. In general, we expect corporate cash to decline in line with our corporate interest expense, which is paid in the second and fourth quarters. I would also remind you that our parent houses roughly $500 million of deferred tax assets, which will ultimately become sources of parent cash as the company's subsidiaries will reimburse the parent for the use of its DTA. With that, I will turn the call back to Steve for closing remarks.
Thank you, Matt. This was clearly a very positive quarter for us as we posted some of the best retail metrics in the firm's history. We exit the quarter with good momentum in the brokerage business, and while trading has moderated in April, currently down 7% from March, we remain encouraged for 2012. Although we are pleased with our progress this quarter, as evidenced by our strong performance in retail brokerage, we will continue to aggressively focus on the retirement and investing category, as this is a key component of our long-term growth strategy. We remain focused on ensuring current and prospective customers are aware of our extensive capabilities in this area through our enhanced marketing and advertising efforts, as well as our financial consultants and retirement specialists. Our legacy risks are less of an overhang each day, and we expect continued runoff of the loan portfolio of approximately $600 to $650 million per quarter in 2012. And provision, while uncertain in any given period, should continue to decline over time, reflecting the long-term trend of declining delinquencies. One final note on our corporate governance. The board made significant enhancements this quarter with the addition of three new board members, our non-executive chairman, Frank Petrelli, Roger Lawson, and Rebecca Sager. We feel honored to have Frank, Roger, and Becky on our board and believe their industry experience will lead to valuable business insights and contributions. With that, operator, we are ready to take questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from Rich Repetto of Sandler O'Neill.
Yeah, good evening, Steve. Good evening, Mike. Matt, excuse me.
Matt. Mike, who is this?
I'm doing so many. I'm doing multiple calls here. But anyway, let me get to my question. For the retail net new assets were just, you know, up dramatically. And I'm just trying to get a little bit more color. What's driving, you know, what, you know, how you increased them? Did it come from any single channel, or you know, how'd you more than double them? I believe they doubled from the last quarter.
Yeah, Rich. Rich. Good afternoon. Good evening. Just a few comments on that. To give you it, or at least to put it in perspective, about half of the volume has come from new customers to E-Trade. And so clearly driving higher levels of net new accounts is critically important to us, and we've been on that trend now since really 2010, and it continues. About half the volume clearly has also come in from existing customers, really benefiting from several, I think, from several items. One, over the last several years, and basically beginning prior to my arrival here, a relentless focus on customer satisfaction and enhanced customer experience. And as I said in the prepared remarks, the attrition rates running now in the eighths is substantially better than what this company has ever experienced before. So keeping our customers is critical, and therefore keeping their assets. And in addition to that, by providing better tools, better platforms, broader products, we're seeing our customers engage more with us now than they have in the past. So it really was on several fronts. One, more high-quality new customers, better experience for our existing customers, and in addition, the corporate services group continues basically to perform extraordinarily well, and it also it's usually a seasonally high period for them in addition to that. So I think it's sort of been the aggregation of all those very positive events that translated into an extraordinary record quarter for the company.
Thank you, Steve. That's very helpful. And then, Matt, the follow-up question would be your very helpful guidance or discussion on the performing second liens. And if I interpret you correctly, are you saying that you will implement this, and once you get certainty, more certainty on the performance of the connected first liens? And the broader question is, you know, is this – as you talk with the regulators, I got a sense that, you know, you've talked more about capital ratios this quarter and sale of non-core assets. Are the regulators encouraging you, you know, to improve the capital ratios specifically, or I guess that's the question.
Yeah, well, I think, Rich, every regulator on the planet would want your capital ratios to improve, of course, but I think that in the prepared remarks, our focus is on putting together a long-term capital forecast, which we are currently working on and plan to submit at the end of the second quarter. So really, we would hope and expect to have some dialogue on that with them in the second half of the year, and that's really where we are.
Yeah, Rich, let me just add to Matt's comments, just a few points, and I think it picks up from the first quarter performance. You know, one, as part of essentially growing the franchise at a quicker pace than we originally anticipated, the balance sheet clearly has grown faster as well. And obviously, in the short term, you get the balances, you get some revenue, but you're basically your capital is deployed immediately. That said, there are a number of actions that I can at least give you perspective on that should be helpful here. One, using Corporate Services Group as a good example, we typically have a high degree of seasonality in the first quarter with some reversion, meaning some of those balances will run off, the cash balances in the second and third, and we're already experiencing that. In a second point to that is we took liberty, given that there seems to be a low elasticity on basically deposit pricing starting April 1, to lower prices on certain of our savings products as well, albeit we don't see a lot of elasticity, so not sure we're going to see a lot of balance runoff, but regardless, it was the right thing to do. Just finally, to sort of frame it on several fronts, one, even from my arrival here, we said over the long term we would expect this balance sheet to reflect more of the customer deposit base than anything else. Well, the customer deposit base today is closer to $30 billion, not $50 billion. There are a number of other items on the balance sheet that either are less capital friendly on a number of measures and or very much non-strategic. And to, I think, Matt's point in his prepared remarks, even though we won't go through specificity right now, we are looking not only for basically more efficiency in our capital, better leverage, but basically fitting that into the strategic frame of the size of the balance sheet with the passage of time. So we're working across it. Some things are easy, and some things are a bit more challenging as we trade off capital, income, and risk.
Thank you. Congrats on a solid quarter here.
Thanks, Rich.
Your next question comes from Michael Carrier of Deutsche Bank.
Thanks, guys. Hey, maybe one follow-up on the net new assets. It does seem like, you know, every first quarter you have a very strong quarter, and so like you mentioned, there's some seasonality, in that. And it seems like in that corporate business, it makes sense. Meaning, if money invests, then you have more cash, that comes in. So I'm just wondering if you can size that up just a bit, because it seems like each year when I look in the past that you get some moderation in the second, third quarter, but obviously, the trends, have been good just in terms of the core organic growth as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can put it in perspective for you by the numbers. So if you take the sequential, the 1.7 growing to 4 billion, roughly the incremental 2.3 billion of growth, we've seen, it's almost evenly split between CSG and I would say non-CSG retail. So we've seen good growth on both fronts. And if you look at it in absolute terms, of the $4 billion, roughly about two-thirds of it is coming in from retail ex corporate services, and about one-third coming in from the corporate services side. Rough numbers, they'll round in either direction. We believe, again, the key here to sustain it is to continue to drive growth in the corporate services group. And if you look at it on a year-on-year basis, the business is getting larger, and the quality of our accounts, our customers, tend to basically improving as well. And then finally, and you have to look at it across the year because any given quarter does have volatility, the number of net new accounts that we acquired in 2011 was twice what we acquired in 2010. And we're on a roll this year to do substantially better in 2012 versus 2011, and that would basically fall back to 2010. So, the question is, can we sustain it? I do agree that we tend to get a seasonal high in the first quarter, but we think there's a core to this that should be sustainable and give us growth on a year-on-year basis throughout the remainder of the year.
Okay, that's helpful. And then maybe just on the regulatory side, so you guys covered a lot, in those comments. I think like probably the two areas that tend to get, focused on, whether it's for the industry or for you guys, is that leverage ratio and then probably the HELOC portfolio. So I think on the leverage ratio, you know, when you look at this quarter, you benefit because you had so much cash come in. But at 5.5%, you know, I'd say if some of the industry, the peers are at 6, 6.5, you know, if you had to, you know, pare those, you know, the assets down, you know, by, I don't know, anywhere from, say, 3 to 6 billion, you know, to get around that range, like what types of assets would those be? Or, you know, said another way, what type of a yield, you know, would you be, you know, giving up there? And then just on the HELOCs, kind of same thing, just in terms of, you know, you mentioned that a lot of those don't reset or they're not going to be starting to pay the principal until 2014. So when you think about just like credit trends, you know, and how to kind of manage that risk, particularly under a new regulator, you know, just how are you thinking through that?
Sure. So on the first question, the leverage ratio, so the 5.5% for the parent, I think the kind of the point Steve made earlier, so that our balance sheet is really liability driven, and specifically our core customer deposit driven, which is the brokerage related cash around $30 billion. So the reason we're up over $50 billion today is two broad buckets, the wholesale funding book, which is around $8 billion, and the bank cash or bank deposits, which is around $8 billion. So those are the two primary areas that we would look to from a deleveraging standpoint. Now, kind of the comments I made in the prepared remarks, given the leverage ratio where it is, the incremental spread is actually pretty low when we're growing the balance sheet. So while the amount of net interest income would likely be less on a smaller balance sheet, spread would actually could possibly improve. So those are the two big buckets we're looking at. Specific to home equities, I think the key takeaway for us is they really don't start amortizing in a meaningful way for several years to that 2014 and beyond. The average home equity, the loan size is relatively small at $60,000. So the actual amount of payment increase that would occur once it begins to amortize is in the $150 to $200 per month range. So when you think about it in the grand scheme of things from a credit perspective, the size of the portfolio that would likely be in 2015 and then the amount of payment that's increasing, it's from our perspective, it's not a huge credit risk.
Yeah, just add one more point, and there's no guarantee the trends sustain themselves, but even using home equity, which clearly has the highest risk profile of our legacy portfolios, if you look year on year, the portfolio contracted, you know, roughly 20%. And so you can think about 14, 15, 16, the absolute size of these portfolios, assuming trends continue, should be substantially smaller tomorrow than they are today, and we've seen these trends and, or maintained these trends for quite a period of time. So again, it doesn't negate it, but what it does say is it becomes smaller, more manageable, more predictable with the passage of time, all things considered.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from Chris Allen of Evercore.
Good evening, guys.
Hi, Chris.
I wonder if we could touch on some of the expense lines, particularly the compensation line, which last quarter you had the software charge, and exiting it out, it was about $11 million sequential increase. I know there's some seasonality there, but that seems rather large. And then the opposite direction on the other operating expenses, a fairly large decline even after adjusting for last quarter. So if you could give us underlying trends, it needs to be helpful.
Sure, Chris. It's probably best to give an overall commentary on expenses, but specific to Q1, from a seasonality perspective, typically comps pretty high in Q1. Taxes are highest during the year in Q1, as well as on the marketing side. Typically, Q1 is our highest marketing quarter.
Sure.
So broadly, we think about a good run rate for expenses on a normal quarter basis of around $290 million, and that's still what we think today. So kind of thinking about the rest of the year, $290 is a good thought process from a run rate. Keep in mind, each individual quarter could move slightly. But that's kind of how we see the rest of the year.
Okay, and then just following up on Mike's question in terms of taking down the balance sheet, I think you said that one of the buckets you look at is the wholesale funding side, but I always understood it to be longer term in nature. Is that still the case, or there's opportunities within that piece?
So it's still the case. So that $8 billion in wholesale funding we estimate will run off over the next 10 years. So it's a rather long time frame. And the prepayment penalties, if you were to just get rid of it today, are rather substantial. They're just under $700 million. So it's not an easy solution, kind of to Steve's earlier point. But when you think about deleveraging, our primary focus is on the core of the companies, that brokerage-related cash. And this wholesale funding of $8 billion and the bank funding of $8 billion is really where we're looking. We just don't have any answers or anything we've decided upon today.
Yeah, and again, I think it's an important just area to clarify. We will get reversion in the second quarter versus the first, which is sort of the natural seasonality of the corporate services group, and not to present numbers today, but it tends to be meaningful. The second is we just did reprice about $5 billion worth of savings. Again, we can't predict elasticity. In the good old days, you would think people were basically price sensitive. They're less price sensitive today, so we'll take the spread, all things being equal, but we did basically bring prices down. And then to Matt's point, the wholesale funding is more of a challenge in the short term because of the cost benefit. That is essentially the mitigating factor. But beyond that, we are looking at opportunities potentially to move certain savings products off our books. We could, if we want, basically direct, for example, new customers to the off-balance sheet sweep versus a deposit product. We have a lot of degrees of freedom, and I think to Matt's point right now, what we're trying to find is the right mix of income, capital, and profile, and that's what we're working on as we speak. You know, we were on one hand pleasantly surprised that we grew much faster than we thought. On the other is we have to deal with the dynamic of that outcome beyond just income. But we will basically have a tangible set of steps in very short order.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Your next question comes from Alex Blostein of Goldman Sachs.
Great. Thanks. Good afternoon, everybody. I wanted to follow up again on just delinquency trends. So if you look at just the change, quote-unquote, in delinquencies, and if you adjust that for the charge-offs, it actually looks like there was a substantial pickup, close to $130 million. And that, again, that looks like one of the higher numbers over the last 2 years or so. So I guess the first question is my math right on that? And if it is a pickup, where are you guys seeing a deterioration in credit? And then as a follow-up to that, looks like your reserves to loans are now also at the lower level since really early 2009. So is that kind of 4.5%-ish a comfortable level for us to think about going forward, or there could be an incremental buildup just to kind of refill that provision bucket?
Sure, Alex. So on the delinquencies, I think the broad comment that we covered in the prepared remarks is we're quite pleased with the decline in delinquencies. So the primary area we focus on are special mention, or 30 to 89 days delinquent, because those are the new loans that have gone delinquent this quarter, so kind of the indicator of where you're going. So we're down to $375 million there. It's down 20% from last quarter. About 5 percentage points of that decline comes from the charge-offs that you referenced. So even when you pull that out, a 15% decline, it's quite a good number from our perspective. And it's really as we talk about each quarter, the portfolio is quite seasoned. We haven't bought loans since early 2007. And each quarter and each year that goes by, it's more and more seasoned, and we expect delinquencies to continue to trend downward. As far as the ratios of reserve to loans, I mean, the way we look at it, given we've got a combination of a qualitative factor, we've got modified loans that we've reserved for, but we've charged off. We kind of look at it a little bit differently, or get a little bit deeper than the overall coverage ratio that you referenced, and kind of looking at it in two buckets. First, the general reserve on non-modified loans, which is $327 million. We look at that as a coverage on non-modified, non-performing loans, and that's around 63%. It's been pretty consistent for quite some time. On the modified side, we look at a combination of the amount of charge-offs we've taken on those loans plus the amount of reserves we still have on the books together. And that's at 37%, and that's actually been increasing over time. So that from a coverage ratio perspective, we're most definitely comfortable, but that's the way we look at it from a management perspective.
Yeah, Alan, just adding one more point, because I think your question started off with, I would say, a directional inconsistency. The delinquencies on a sequential basis showed substantial contraction, not expansion. If you look at it, and I'll talk home equity first, in the quarter, the 30 to 179 were down 27%. The 90 to 179 were down 20%. And the 89 were down 31%. Those are our reported statistics. The 1 to 4 family did not have as good, but had on any basis very good performance. 30 to 179 down 15. 90 to 179 down 16. And 30 to 89 down 15%. And the way we report on the first versus the second versus the home equity is on an actual calendar. first lag by 1 month. So even though we call it the quarter, it's February actual data. When you look at March data, which we'll release in about a month or so from now, but directionally, it looks almost identical to home equity. So we feel extraordinarily good about delinquency trends in the first quarter. I want to make sure nobody misinterprets that.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I appreciate the comment. I was basically just making an observation that the total delinquencies declined but adjusted for the charge-offs.
Yeah, and even home equity, just to help you, because we've done the math, because home equity was where the impacts would have been most evident, that basically that roughly 30% improvement, about two-thirds of that we would describe as organic, independent of the write-downs, so about 20% if you excluded them, and 30% or so if you included them. So regardless, we do feel that the natural trend in the portfolio looks quite good, and the reported trend looks extremely good, but you have to take into account that those write-downs did, in fact, have some positive impact, at least on the optics.
Gotcha. That's very helpful. Thanks. And then the second question for me was just if you could comment on the trading activity so far in April. Feels like it's gotten a little bit softer, but curious to hear how you guys are, what you guys are seeing.
Yeah, again, you may have missed it. I think, in my prepared remarks, said that on a sequential basis, March into the first half or so of April, we've seen a sequential decline of approximately 7%. But as you know, it's a very volatile set of measures, and 10 days or so of 10 business days really won't make up a quarter. But nonetheless, the trading is a bit subdued relative to what we had seen in March.
Understood. Thanks, guys.
Your next question comes from Chris Harris of Wells Fargo Securities.
Thanks. Good evening, guys.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, so just want to follow up on that last point there. Some of your peers have commented that the retail investor is starting to kind of disengage. They're decreasing their tolerance for risk, and I kind of see what's happening with your trends here and see that margin lending, I guess, has kind of declined as a percent of client assets. So really just wondering what you guys are seeing out there, whether you're seeing similar things happening within the retail investor landscape, whether folks are really starting to kind of de-risk or be cautious, or whether you're not really seeing as much of that.
I don't see precisely the same trend. Let me just give you some statistics that maybe will help you draw your own set of conclusions. One, and Matt referred to it in his remarks, that even though average on average our margin receivables were flat fourth quarter to first quarter, on a quarter end to quarter end basis, margin receivables are actually up about $500 million, which is about 10%. And it's the first real significant positive movement we've seen in margin in probably close to a year, because the trend in 2011 was a downward trend largely, and the trend basically has been an upward trend. In fact, if you look into the first half of the month of April, margin is actually continuing to move in a very positive way. In addition to that, if you looked at basically the fourth quarter of 2011 for us, we basically had option activity in our darts running around 22%, and that was up from about 19% a year ago in the first quarter, and the first quarter of this year we're a little bit above 23%. So from the standpoint of the type of instruments people are utilizing and the amount of leverage they're taking on, and obviously there's leverage in options, there's leverage, clearly basically margin is leverage, we're not seeing the same, but we do see a fair amount of volatility depending upon the information that's released in any given period into the market as to whether the retail investors are in or out. So we see a lot of volatility in that, and it's hard to discern a real trend on darts in any given day or week. But the trends that we do see is option activity continues to rise, and in addition to that, margin expansion continues to march on. So, again, I don't want to take that and translate that into a consumer confidence metric. But at the same time, if you look at behavior, people are behaving in a way that manifests itself possibly as more confidence. But clearly, these trends are still over several quarters, and I still think we need more data points to conclude anything. But we're often, I mean, it feels better, I mean, given that leverage is basically coming into play.
That's very helpful, Steve. Thank you. And then just my follow-up question would be, on the kind of the regulatory transition review period. You know, I know it's obviously a fluid situation, but your commentary there, I think you'd mentioned that you feel pretty confident that there won't be another qualitative reserve. Just wondering if you can expand a little bit more on that, what it is that the regulators are looking at and what kind of gives you the confidence that you do you think you won't have additional qualitative reserve going forward?
Sure. So just to clarify the comments, I think we are quite confident that our reserves in the quarter are adequate, but I think we're also quite confident that our regulators are going to review the performance of these modified loans and our reserve levels very closely going forward, and there most certainly could be changes that could result that could happen as a result of that. But from a management perspective, we're quite comfortable with it. But just keep in mind the allowance itself, by its very nature, is an estimate, and it's inherently uncertain. So it could always change based on in future periods.
Yeah, and just let me finish up. Even in the press release, I think the best way to express it is that, you know, we're going through a regulatory transition from our bank regulator prior with the OTS to both the OCC and at the parent, the Fed. And it's not just a point in time. It is clearly a journey. We think we're on the road. We think we have a good relationship with our regulators. To Matt's point, we feel confident that what we've done is, in fact, aligning and adequate. But at the same time, it's a dynamic process. The world changes, things change, and we don't want to basically say definitively we started on X date and we finished on Y date. But that said, this is an important transition. We take it very seriously. We think we're executing well, and we'll continue to basically march forward. But the primary focus, or I would say one of the main areas we focused in on in Q1 was the ALLL, and we worked through that, and we think we've come to a reasonable solution. But again, processes are dynamic.
Great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Your next question comes from Howard Chen of Credit Suisse.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Howard.
Just given the action in the HELOC TDRs to conform with your regulator standards, I'm curious what percentage of those $215 million of charge-offs are still cash flowing?
So when you see, you mean total charge-offs on home equities? Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah, in home equities.
Yeah, so I think if you think broadly of the total charge-offs for the quarter, which were $315 million, about half of that came from this review. I think the amount of cash that's cash flowing is not a number we have in front of us, but it's probably not the gating factor separate and apart from the fact that we charge them off, and we feel quite comfortable where our reserves are today. The cash flowing or not, it's not, from our perspective, it's not going to have a meaningful impact on those reserves going forward, because it's the principal amount as opposed to the interest that they would pay that's going to be the key driver of those losses.
Okay. Thanks, Matt. And then on your commentary regarding the reserving policy for HELOCs behind the non-performing first, if your current visibility isn't great and you don't have all the enhanced tools that you want yet, you know, what's driving your confidence that the ultimate figure will be considerably less than the current estimate?
Sure. So we kind of have two buckets there. One, the confidence of or getting the clarity on data specific to a borrower who's paying their second lien but delinquent on some other loan. We have clarity that they're delinquent on something. And that clarity is factored into our overall loss modeling. The clarity that we don't have is whether that delinquency is specific to the first mortgage loan. So it could be on their mortgage. It could be on their auto loan payment. It could be on their Nordstrom card payment. It could be on anything. So that's the clarity that we need to get to be able to factor in this regulatory guidance. But to the provisioning itself, that delinquency is factored in.
Yeah, just to add, you know, going back to the numbers that were cited by Matt, if you think about it, the sort of the superset, which we addressed as 10%, and I know Matt has just made the point, but I think it's important, again, to add just one more clarification, is any product they could be delinquent on. It could be a $100 delinquency on their credit card. Also, from a logic standpoint, if you're paying your second, there's probably a low probability that you're not paying your first. Not an absolute, but a lower. So when you think about it logically, if 10% is the superset, the question is, what do you think a first mortgage behind our second would be? We think it'll be a relatively speaking or considerably lower subset of that number, and that's what we'll get clarity on across the quarter, and it does go to basically the accrual of interest, not so much basically provisioning, because we incorporate that data already from the standpoint of delinquency into our modeling. I would bet it's a very low number, but I could be wrong, but we know basically what the absolute top is, and we'll have to see where we come out.
Got it. Thanks. And then last one for me. Earlier this year, you struck an agreement with FXCM to offer foreign exchange. Could you just provide some early progress on that partnership, and maybe as a baseline, you know, what's FX as a percentage of your, you know, DARTs today? Thanks.
Yeah, I'll give you perspective. We think it's important from the standpoint of a service to provide to some of our more sophisticated active traders. From the standpoint of registering on DARTs at the moment, you wouldn't see it in an absolute term in our DARTs data. It's extremely small. It would round off. But we're in early stages. The partnership's good. We've executed it well. We have, I would say, maybe a couple of hundred of our customers engaged. But the numbers are not large at this point. So they're not material. They wouldn't register, although we're at the early stages.
Great. Thanks for taking the questions.
Your next question comes from Joel Jeffrey of KBW.
Good evening, guys.
Hi, Joel.
Just a quick clarification. I apologize if I missed this earlier. When you talked about if the balance sheet remains at current levels, did you say the spread would be at 240 basis points at the end of the year or average 240?
Average 240 for the year. So Q1 was 249, so something less than 240 for the rest of the year.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then I think in the past you've talked about a sort of a more normalized spread of 3%. And sort of given your commentary about, you know, where the balance sheet's going in terms of size and your some level of inflexibility on the wholesale funding side, I mean, would we have to wait until the wholesale funding basically runs off to see that kind of number, or is there anything else you could do to get the NIM back to that level?
So the 300 basis points, Joel, is the, what we think over the long term the balance sheet would produce on a customer-driven balance sheet, meaning primarily funded by brokerage customer cash, and in a more normalized environment. So that customer-funded balance sheet, the wholesale funding would have run off. The investment strategy on the asset side would have continued. So it's a very long-term thing. So I think the odds of being in a more normalized interest rate environment anytime soon are pretty slim. So our focus is more on where the spread is heading today.
Okay, great. And then just lastly, you guys looked like you had another sort of decent pickup in the held to maturity bucket on the balance sheet. Can you talk about how you think about putting something in either available for sale versus held to maturity?
Sure. So we've been growing the held to maturity book in line with essentially the growth in customer cash. But as the balance sheet gets bigger, we've been growing the held to maturity book. Given where the balance sheet is right now, our target is to grow that to $10 billion and pause there.
Great. Thanks for taking my questions.
Your next question comes from Keith Murray of Nomura.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Keith.
Could you just spend a minute on, you know, the capital plan and the stress test? Do you have a sense yet of whether or not they'll be focusing on risk-based ratios like the CCAR process for the large banks focused on Tier 1 Common?
Well, I suspect any and all regulators are going to focus on what your most constraining ratio is. So specific to the bank, our Tier 1 Common ratio is just under 16%, so incredibly strong from our perspective, versus the leverage ratio, which is much lower at 7.3. So we suspect when we do all the work, which we haven't done yet, but our plans are to get it done and submitted at the end of the second quarter, that the leverage ratio is likely to be the most constraining ratio, and that's where the focus would likely be.
Yeah, you may just want to clarify that we're not going through a CCAR, a specific CCAR in the second quarter.
Right.
But nonetheless, I think, you know, Matt's points are extremely relevant in that most of our ratios are very strong. We always look for the constraining ratio, both at the parent and at the bank. It tends to be the leverage ratio.
Thanks. And then thoughts around refinancing the 12.5% notes. Do you feel like you'd rather wait to get clarity on the capital plan from the regulators before you move forward on that, or is that independent of that?
So they're most certainly connected. So the refinance of the 12.5% notes, if you just look at the last time we issued last year, we issued at 6.75%. So the economics of a refinance would be incredibly positive. At the same time, they were issued at a pretty large discount, and the premium that you would have to pay to do that, collectively, you'd have a rather large loss in the refinance, driving down the capital ratios. So we really look at balancing those two things together.
Okay, thanks. And then last one, you mentioned about half the net new money coming from new accounts. Can you talk about the quality of those new accounts versus existing?
Yeah, I mean, we keep a very, as you'd expect, a very close eye on quality. Accounts without quality are not really worth much to us. And at least over the last several years, there's been a very focused effort not just to basically look at accounts, but to look at the quality of accounts coming in. And I would say on balance, and I'll give you a perspective, on balance, our average new account brings to us somewhere in the neighborhood of about $25,000, and it kind of varies by channel and varies by type. We typically think if a new account opening on average is at least $20,000, that's a good thing. And that typically grows on average to about $60,000 over the course of an 18-month or so period of time. And the accounts that we've been bringing on, at least for the 2 years that I've been here, have more than met that criteria. And so we like the economics, the dynamics, and the payback of it just to reassure the group that we're not basically looking for accounts. We're looking for quality accounts.
Got it. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Brian Bedell of ISI Group.
Hi, good evening, folks.
Good evening, Brian.
Just to a little bit more on the balance sheet, can you talk a little bit about what you think will be the stickiness of the deposit growth in the first quarter in terms of whether you think that will be deployed back into risk assets or whether the deposit pricing strategy that you're talking about for the savings rate will have any kind of material impact on that. And then can you just remind me about what exactly you're doing with the deposit rate? I think you said April 1st.
Yeah, so the deposit rate was specific to a bank product on April 1st, from 15 basis points to 5. As far as the investment strategy goes, there's no change in the investment strategy, which is to allow the loan portfolio to run off and to invest in government-backed or agency-backed securities. So little to no credit risk on the asset side, and no change there at all.
And so on the deposit base, in terms of the customers, I guess, behavior, if you could sort of characterize what you think customers might do in this environment in terms of redeploying those deposits into securities or kind of stay put.
Yeah, just to kind of give you maybe a contextual frame. Typically, our experience has been that customers keep somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 20% of their financial assets with us in cash. We've trended closer to, I would say, 18, 19 in this environment, let's say, speculating that they have a higher degree of conservatism. And so I would expect as confidence levels rise, you would see it recede back towards 15. And if people remained conservative, it probably stays on the higher side of that range. So trying to predict over the short term with any certainty, sort of the psyche is tough. But the range tends to basically give you a pretty good indication. Now, when you talk about folks who carry today, I think it's almost in excess of $200 billion of financial assets with us, percentage points really matter. But we're probably now in the higher end of the range, which is not unexpected. I don't know if that helps you build a model from, but it sort of range bounds. We don't think the 15 to 20 falls to 5 to 10, and we don't think it rises to 30 or 40. And we've gone back over long periods of time, and the range tends to basically be a good indicator. But within that range, there could be a lot of variation.
Okay, yeah, that's very helpful. And then just one more on the balance sheet. On the loan side, we've been going down about 20 to 25 basis points per quarter. Can you characterize on the ARM repricing, what type of impact you think that might have in the second, third, and fourth quarters in terms of the rate?
Sure, Brian. Probably the best thing to reiterate is of the repricings of the resets that we expected this year, about half happened in the first quarter. So the majority of the impact happened in the first quarter, and we would expect that to subside a bit later in the year.
Okay, great. And then just lastly, on the wholesale borrowing, that went up a little bit on a net basis. Do you expect that trend to continue through the year?
No, I mean, wholesale is a little bit choppy, and you've got hedges applied to that book. I think that the broad comment I would stick to on wholesale is why it could move around a little bit here and there. Our expectations are simply to run that portfolio off over a long period of time, and the individual items or the individual yields per quarter could be a little bit choppy.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much.
This concludes the Q&A portion of today's call. I would now like to turn the floor back over to Mr. Steve Freiberg for any closing remarks.
Thank you again for joining us tonight, and we look forward to speaking with you again next quarter. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Thank you. This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.